Hello all, welcome to Pyramid Podcast, where three lads discuss all things English football pyramid. On today's episode, we'll dissect the Man City versus Arsenal game and what it means for the rest of the season. Are Chelsea actually a good side following a 3-0 victory at West Ham? Villa have picked up where they left off last season. Are they top four residents now? United and Tottenham begin their Europa League campaigns this week. We'll have a roundup of the key EFL stories and we'll finish with Laura, who provide us with our weekly YTFC update. I'm your host, Alex Murphy, and once again, I'm joined by Tom Gallagher and Tom Lawrence. Boys, let's start with the game at the Etihad on Sunday. Laura, a game that ultimately ended with a point apiece, 2-2, but what did you make of it?
Left with great sadness. Obviously, it's very difficult to watch the end of a career that's been at the top, the top of their game for such a long time. And I think that's what we saw with Michael Oliver at the weekend. And I hope he doesn't feel like he's let himself and his family down too much, because he can look back with fondness as long as there's not too many more days like that. But I thought from the start, literally from the start, when there was probably a booking in the first second of the game, right to the very end where he cheated everyone out of 2 minutes of football, to the sending off of Leandro Trossard, where he went black and white, where I think he had a choice there and a decision to make where he could have kept him on the pitch, down to the, trying to mind read players as to whether they were feigning cramp or not, not blowing up for time wasting and then actually blowing up 5-10 seconds later and just getting it all horribly wrong. So, I left with great pity on the footballing world that we were left with a game that was much less competitive in terms of goal scoring after half time, because he decided to interfere with the amount of people that each team had on the pitch. And I thought it went from bad to worse for a guy that started the game looking like he was trying to old man everyone and left it probably with his career in tatters at the top game, at the top of his game. And it'll be up to him whether he's got the hunger to carry on refereeing probably down in the doldrums of non-league beyond this season. But as you can probably tell, I thought he had a very negative effect on what was looking like a very, very good competitive football match. And one that I thought, if it had remained 11v11, may have just seen a little changing of a guard where Arsenal could have actually picked up 3 points at the Etihad, which is what has eluded them in seasons gone by. So a great shame was my take on the game.
I know, obviously, refereeing aside, it was a late equaliser for John Stones to rescue a point for City, and obviously Arsenal would have come away with 3 points. But do you think before the game, Tomo, that if you'd have offered Arteta a point at the Etihad, and well, he wouldn't want a Rodri injury, but hindsight of one of City's best players going to be missing for a large remainder of the season, he'd have taken it?
Yeah, given the context of what happened, he probably would have taken that in the at half-time as well, wouldn't he, after Trossard's sending off. I do feel like Trossard's given the referee a decision to make there. And although we're all football fans here and we do want 11v11, and actually the game was highly entertaining when it was 11v11, but it's not really the referee's job to make sure at all costs that it stays 11v11. If Trossard kicks the ball away, which he does, and everyone's pretty much agreed that he has, and it wasn't just sort of like a tap of the ball, like a couple yards away, he's booted the ball 25 yards away. It does feel like he's given a decision, the referee a decision to make. So I feel a little bit sorry for Michael Oliver in that incident. But and when it comes to sort of the minutiae of his performance, I will say I listened to the game on the radio, and I've obviously since done Match of the Day and done the highlights. He did get quite a few things wrong, but it felt like he got quite a few things wrong for both sides. So it almost, in a kind of perverse way, evened itself out a little bit. I think it's a positive point for Arsenal overall, given the context of the game. What I'd like to pick up on is the sort of the post-match comments from quite a lot of the City players. They're all saying how Arsenal are anti-football, and how Bernardo Silva in particular compared them to Liverpool, and Liverpool always came to win, and their games were much more entertaining. And I think that's a good sign for Arsenal, because I think that means that they're getting under City's skin, and City know that Arsenal are right there in a title fight. This season, probably last season as well. Like, once Trossard's sending off happens, that second half was just inevitable. And Arsenal, and that second half was such a good performance from Arsenal, considering the 10 v 11. And I don't really know why anyone can criticise that Arsenal second half performance, just because how else are you going to play against how else are you going to play with 10 men for 45 minutes against Man City at the Etihad? You can't. There's nothing else you can do apart from just sit in a low block and essentially keep Man City to like long range shots from Diaz and Akanji and the likes of those guys. So I think it was an unbelievable performance from Arsenal and a really encouraging one. And even though he didn't get the win, I do think it's a sign that Arsenal will probably go on and win the title.
Yeah, I thought it was a magnificent performance from Arsenal in the second half and a brilliant indictment on Arteta's management and the control that he's got over that group. If you think, other than probably Arsenal and Liverpool, nearly every single team in the Premier League go to Man City with 11 players and try to play like that all game anyway. So to do it with 10 men in a half and for everyone to come away thinking, hang on a minute, City are devoid of ideas here. I mean, Bernardo Silva and people like that coming out talking about anti-football. No, boys, you are anti-football. We all hate you. We hate watching Man City. You've completely destroyed the Premier League. You play really efficient winning football. Well done. But we all hate watching it. It's absolute crap. And the best thing about that football game on Sunday was watching Arsenal's 6-3-0 formation keep you completely at bay and cost you all ideas. And you're right. It ended up with Ruben Dias having about, you know, 1,000 touches in the second half. And every single time he looked like he wanted to line up a 30-yard pile driver and ended up passing it wide. And the only reason they had time to score at the end is because the referee added on 7 minutes. And I believe Opta have come out and said the second half of that football match, the ball was in play for more minutes than any other half of any other game in the Premier League this season. So more investigations needed in terms of the integrity of the officiating. But absolutely amazing from Arsenal. And it's an unbelievable point, a great point. Of course, they'd have taken that before the game. Within the context of it being so close and feeling probably slightly cheated out of it, of course, it'll be disappointing, but fantastic to go to the Etihad with 10 men in the second half and come away with something.
Can I just make the point, though, that it was clear for everyone to see that Arsenal were wasting time. That Lewis Miles Skelly got booked because as a substitute, he ran over to David Raya and he told him to go down and waste time. And that's exactly what happened. So the referee and the officials were all aware what was going on. I'm not sitting here and saying, like Man City players were saying, like, they shouldn't be doing that. I think Arsenal should absolutely do that in the second half. And at the end of the day, that probably plays into the sort of the mindset of the officials where they're going, look, they're obviously going down and faking like cramp. And you have to sort of take that into account when you're adding the time on. I'm not saying you should sit there and basically play until City score, but it was clear for all to see what was happening. And I guess the officials tried to counteract that with their added on time. I don't think Arsenal should be criticised for what they're doing, like City have come out and done. But I'm just almost playing devil's advocate on the sort of official side of it.
And in doing so, you've plunged them further into obscurity, because you're absolutely right. They've taken it into their own hands to start adding on time, because they believe there was time wasting. There was times when players were going down with cramp and Michael Oliver was saying, get up, get up. You know, this happens in every single football match when a team is leading. Every single one. Every single week when I go and watch Oval play at Hewish Park, whoever's winning, players go down, they slow the game down, they feign injury. The keeper will always go down because he's one that doesn't have to come off if he gets treatment. It happens in every single game. So if you're going to start adding time on for that when you're guessing if someone's feigning injury or not, you've got to do it across the board. But they didn't, and they don't. They did it on Sunday because they thought, oh, this is a top-level game and it's Man City away. And you know, we can't be letting them get away with that. No, do it in every game. Do it when Brentford are 1-0 up at Crystal Palace and are going down and feigning injury. Don't just add 3 minutes on there. We want 7 and then the additional 2 afterwards. So, you know, I left absolutely furious at exactly that. You're right. I hate all the time wasted in football matches. But Arsenal were allowed to do it at Man City, just like any other team were allowed to do it at any other point. And they deserve consistency and they didn't get it.
Could you not move to, like, navigate the the time wasting to a style that's used in like rugby, where it's literally the ball is in play and the clock's running. It goes out for a throw in, it stops until the ball's back in. A goal kick, it starts when the kick's taken by the keeper. There must be, with all of the technology that we've got now, where we are with VAR, goal line technology, all of the other semi-automated things that we use in, there must be a way that we can just have the clock running while the ball's in play. And then that all stops. If someone goes down with cramp, yeah, they'll still go down because they want to get a breather and they want everyone to be able to just take a minute, get their breath back, reset up in defensive line. That's absolutely fine. You do that. But the shot clock or the game clock stops for the minute and a half you're down. And then it's black and white. There's no, oh, where's he got 7 minutes from? Or, oh, that seems a bit light. It will just be paused. The game will be paused. You will play 90 minutes of football.
Yeah, well, there must be some sort of reasons behind that in terms of policing and when do they let the crowd out, etc., and train times and all that sort of stuff, travel issues. What I will say is, like this time wasting thing that everyone seems to want to solve, and it's like the worst thing to ever happen, it's quite entertaining. Like that second half, although it's like anti-football and it was defense versus attack, it was dramatic, it was entertaining, it was sort of everything you almost want in a title decider. Like I don't really get this whole, like, this massive uproar about trying to solve this time-wasting thing. It's a part of football. It will always happen. It's gamesmanship. It's what happens when the fine margins in football sort of separate the win and the loss. So, and even if they do solve this issue with, say, it's almost like a game of whack-a-mole. They'll solve one issue with one more rule, but the players and the managers will come up with another sort of time-wasting tactic that season, and then they'll have to go again. So I'm not really sure. I don't understand. There's no outcry to sort of solve this massive issue. It's not, for me anyway, it's not turning me away from the game where I'm like, oh, Man City are 2-1 up against Brentford and they're wasting time in the corner. I'm sitting there as a football fan going, yeah, of course they are, because they're winning 2-1 and it's the 89th minute. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. But don't then, as an Arsenal fan, sit there and say there's a conspiracy against Arsenal when Declan Rice gets sent off for kicking the ball away when Van Hecht's about to take a quick free kick. And don't get pissed off when Trossard boots the ball away and gets sent off. If you're going to practice the dark arts and you're going to do the time wasting, you're going to pick up bookings, and then people are going to be on a treading a tight line. And if you want to allow Michael Oliver, who got lots wrong at the weekend, to make a decision, then you can't then sit there as a fan base and be like, it's corrupt, the Prem's corrupt, we're getting cheated out of it. That Trossard made that choice and he got sent off for it. But yeah.
And also, can we just say, actually, I do think Man City, with the equaliser, albeit an unbelievable finish from Calafiori, Michael Oliver's called Carl Walker and Bukayo Saka as the captains to come and have a chat with him. And he's not really let Carl Walker get back into position and set. He's almost let him get back into position almost just a second before, and then the free kick's been taken. So, but Arsenal are happy to take that sort of advantage, but not in the other scenarios. So that's what I said at the start of the conversation. Like, yeah, Michael Oliver was poor, but I almost think he was poor in both aspects. So it's almost ruled each other out a little bit.
Well, aside from the game itself, Laurie, one other massive incident that happened, aside from the result, sorry, is the injury to Rodri. I think he was tackled pretty firmly really early into the game, and then he came off after another challenge, and it looks like he's got a bad knee injury. And we always see the graphics pop up about City with and without Rodri. And, you know, Arsenal took the point from there, but the Rodri injury might be the biggest result for them of the day.
Yeah, that would be massively significant, won't it, in the title race. I think a lot of us are predicting that this would be the year that Arsenal do pit Man City, and maybe that margin will be a little wider, because like you said, I remember we had a podcast around this time last season and Rodri was out for the game against Wolves, and the first thing I said was I fancy Wolves might get something, and they won the next day. And I think that they went through a little period of maybe four games without a result, or without a win after that. And that's how important he is. And that's probably the biggest gulf drop in quality they've got between a player and the understudy, going from Rodri to maybe Kovacic, who's a good player, but not an elite player. Like, Rodri's the best in his position in the world and is a real difference maker in games. And he's a monster, isn't he? So to lose him for the season is is catastrophic. And yes, definitely a big plus for Arsenal.
And then one final stat I just want to touch on from that game as well is the fact that Kai Havertz and Jurrien Timber, two players who obviously shone for Arsenal at the start of the season, Tom, am I right in saying completed zero passes to teammates? And it's the first time anyone who's played 89 plus minutes, which is a bit of a weird time to give, because I assume there's someone who's played 88 minutes and not done it before, but first time that that's happened.
Yeah, but that's more a sort of a indictment on what happened in the second half. To be honest, I wouldn't read too much into that, because it was just a game of two different halves, and the second half was a complete mismatch. And the way Arsenal went about it, when they brought on Ben White and just went five at the back and played four in front of them, you just knew that sort of those kind of stats aren't surprising when that sort of tactics are employed in the second half.
I think it was like a back five, wasn't it? And I said on our group chat 5-4-0, and Laura, you came back and said it was more like a 6-3-0, wasn't it? Like Calafiori was almost tucking in, and Martinelli was like paying out at left back. So yeah, it was proper backs against the wall stuff. But I thought it was fantastic in spells watching City aimlessly pass it about, like Carragher and Neville were doing their nut, that it was just Diaz stood there like spreading the ball out side to side to side, and then every so often they'd whip a cross in, and that's where Gabriel, Saliba or Raya was collecting the ball and looking brilliant as well. So made some big saves as well, Raya. So yeah, it was great to see them. I do just want to raise one more thing as well, Laurie, before we do move on, and that was around Gabriel. He obviously has been in the headlines from the set pieces and scoring goals. He had one which he put over the bar just before, and I think they changed to put Kyle Walker on him. And there's a video of Kyle Walker almost like jabbing him. And you said the whole world was watching Gabriel from that corner, and he still managed to get there and score.
Yeah, I actually thought the commentary was quite good at explaining how they managed to do that. It's like every other player is crowding the goalkeeper in the back posts, making sure that no one else can really get a run or a jump to compete for the ball. And it leaves Gabriel one-on-one with anyone. And if you're putting Gabriel one-on-one with anyone in the world, he's trying to attack the ball, and they're sort of having to backpedal and defend. There's quite often only going to be one winner. So it'd be interesting to see how teams start to try and counteract that, because it seems a bit of a cheat code at the minute. It got to the point where literally last week, the commentators called it before the goal, and they did it almost on both corners this time as well. So yeah, lethal, and obviously very, very effective from set pieces at the moment, Arsenal. Gabriel, great game again. I'll just one last point. I thought Jack Grealish changed the game for Man City in the 5 minutes that he had at the end. He was actually able to sort of run defenders at a couple of different angles, commit players out a little bit more and find space in behind and whip some balls in and earn some corners and just get things going a little bit more in the penalty area rather than around it, which was probably 99% of the half. So fair play to Jack Grealish, and I cannot believe he doesn't get in over Doku.
Especially when the game goes like that, where they're going to be sat in front, like sat really deep. Doku's all about getting in behind, right, and using his pace, because we know his end product's not brilliant. So when you've got two banks of 5 and 4 or 6 and 3 in front of you, why Grealish isn't on there winning fouls, drifting past people, bringing people and knocking past them? I don't know why Pep left that so late, but yeah, quick thinking from the corner and led to the equaliser. So fair play to him. Right, boys, let's move on from that game then. And I just want to quickly pick up on Chelsea, who won 3-0. I was actually driving to my football game on Saturday, and TalkSport was on in the morning. And one of the pundits that came on said that his hot take of the season so far was that he actually thought Chelsea were a good side. And I was listening to it, thinking about the Bournemouth game where they were quite lucky to win it and games they'd lost. But they looked fantastic against West Ham. And Lauren, Nicholas Jackson, a striker you've already called out this season, got a brace.
Yeah, I thought Nicholas Jackson kind of ended last season quite well. Like this time last season, we were looking at him thinking there's a lot to like about him. He's energetic, he's quick, he gets in the right positions, but I thought his finishing was terrible. And he kind of got to grips with that towards the end of last season. And then the first game this season, they played Man City. He didn't score, but he looked really dangerous, and not many times you see a striker look that dangerous against Man City. He was off the shoulder and he was twisting and turning and getting himself into really good positions, and I just thought against a lot of teams in the Prem this season that will give them kittens, and it has so far. So he's a player that's really, really grown on me, and I think could be big goals this season for Chelsea. And in terms of them as being a good team or not. It's a difficult one because Chelsea, they've always had good players. Last season, they had really good players. They're probably one of the best players in the league in Cole Palmer and a few others as well. It's just about whether they can gel. And so far, and it's really, really early, it does look like the kind of you're either with me or not attitude from Maresca, where he's bomb squad half of the team and kept the others with him, seems to be working. And it was quite scary at the weekend when they were a few ahead against West Ham and they were able to bring off Jackson and Palmer and bring on the likes of João Félix and Pedro Neto and players like that. So, yeah, I mean, it's a really, really good start. I think we need to see a little bit more from them to see whether it's going to be substantial enough to carry them into the European places towards the end of the year. But so far, they look very good. But, I mean, I'll let Tomo come in and comment. I don't know if you watched the game, Tomo, but West Ham were absolutely shocking and it's a dire start for Lopetegui.
Yeah, I mean, we spoke a lot last season about David Moyes and if his name was David Moisetegui, I think he'd still be in a job because, and it also goes to show actually of falling into the trap of placing like so much importance on how you get on in the transfer window because on the surface it felt like they did quite a good job. They bought some pretty sensible signings, made some good acquisitions. Max Kilman being, I think, one of the top ones. He was unbelievable for Wolves last season. But, and it probably is a little bit too early to say, but yeah, they've certainly been piss poor this year. And it'd be interesting to see how quickly it turns and whether or not the West Ham fans are a little bit like, well, we hounded David Moyes out, so we need to give this guy a bit more time. Almost a double down on their feelings last year. But yeah, look, Like you said, Chelsea are a good team. Nicholas Jackson, I think if you remember this time last season, I think I come on here and basically said, look, I really like him. He does everything except score. And then it got to about 6 months into the season and I was like, I completely wrote him off. I was like, nah, he's done. But then you forget, he was 22 last year. He's just turned 23. So, and it's quite often these strikers, something clicks and they go on a run and then all of a sudden they're just a bagsman for the rest of their career. And obviously Chelsea will be hoping for that because like Laura said, he is actually quite a likeable striker given how hard he works and all of the sort of like off the ball stuff he does.
Just one more on West Ham. I think that they're already turning on Lopetegui. He took Somerville off in the second half and the whole place just erupted with boos. And there's losing football matches and then there's how you lose them. And all three of Chelsea's goals was literally like, it looked like a team of kids could have scored them. It was a simple ball through in the middle. Nicholas Jackson just ran past everyone as if they weren't there. And the other two were just defence splitting passes from, one of them was Caicedo and Jackson was one-on-one with the keeper from within his own half. And Palmer's was a good break as well. So I think it's going to be really difficult already for Lopetegui to come back. I think he'll be the first manager sacked this season, him or maybe O'Neill at Wolves, but I think it's that bad.
Just on West Ham as well, it's like they're like a club in it that always have this kind of like identity crisis where they're like a mid-table Premier League club and when they perform well, they're obviously a European club and then it almost feels like that they need to sign the sort of better quality players just to sort of turn the screw a little bit on that and then push to the higher echelons of the table. But when they sign, it feels like when they sign these better quality players, they tend to be the players who might not put in do that 110% extra sort of level of effort and put in the shift for you. And then all of a sudden you lose a couple of games, the confidence goes down and then you're looking at sort of like the other side of the Premier League table. So they're in a difficult spot. They've been in a difficult spot for basically 5, 6, 7 years. And it'd be interesting to see if this sort of this slow start continues, whether or not Lopetegui changes. And if they do sack him, who do they bring in? Because we all know David Moyes has been there a couple of times already.
Well, this is exactly what we were debating on the pod back end of last season, was like, you know, pressure was starting to mount on David Moyes. It felt like a natural conclusion, but He won a European trophy for them. I think last year, did they finish ninth West Ham, which would have put them, you know, the top four was City, Arsenal, Liverpool, Villa. You then had the likes of Tottenham, Chelsea, Newcastle, Man United. Which of those teams are West Ham wanting to finish above? I know they've obviously recruited in the summer with Kilman, Somerville, Fulcrook, people like that. But I just don't know what West Ham fans beyond ninth are hoping for. Like, they were 8 points behind United and Newcastle. I guess they could say they want to close that gap for the European places. But I just don't see where, like, for me, ninth is a brilliant finish for West Ham, given the size of the clubs that are in the league now. So what's the saying? Is it better the devil you know, or something like that? Or fuck around, find out?
But this is, I think, so just to stick up for West Ham fans in a small way, I actually think they almost know that fact and they're not accepting of it, but like they know that there's sort of a ceiling and a limit to how far they can get, given the sort of the financial disparities between the big clubs and the West Hams of this world. It's how West Ham finish 8th, 7th, 9th. If they finish 8th, 7th, 9th, or whichever one of those playing like Brighton, where it's like exciting, good football, but they obviously lose games because they haven't got the squad to sort of deal with the long season, I guess, then they'd probably be a little bit more accepting of that than if they finish ninth under David Moyes, where you're basically playing counter-attacking football, giving up possession every week and just hoping to nick a draw, hoping to nick a win. That's kind of the identity crisis we're talking about, which sort of half of the coin do you want to go on?
Was it not? I mean, for me, they had still had Kudus, Pakatar, Bowen, and looked electric going forward in spells last season. So, well, look, you're seeing now that they're not picking up the points. They've brought a new manager in who's got a foreign name and might have a more attacking philosophy, but it's not working out for him so far. Boys, let's move on to a team that have brought in a foreign manager over recent years and having some success, and that's Aston Villa. They're third in the Premier League table, 12 points from a possible 15, off to a winning start in the Champs League as well. Laura, are they just a resident top four, top five club now in the Premier League? Are they going to be challenging for that top four for years to come?
I'd imagine so. I don't know about resident top four, but they're in the conversation along with like your Newcastles and probably your Man Uniteds now, aren't they? They're in that kind of pool of team, I would say. Like I said before this season, I think they've got a group of really good, strong kind of international players. I've tipped them to do well in the Champions League because I think they've got a lot of players in there that are used to kind of the bigger occasions. A lot of them are big players for their respective national teams. And they've got a couple of really big match winners. And obviously, Ollie Watkins has found his scoring boots as well lately as well. So that's going to help them. And I think they've sort of been backed quite well financially in the last few transfer markets since Unai Emery's been there, and all things are definitely going in the right direction. But there's, like you say, there's one thing getting to fourth and getting to the Champions League, and there's another thing staying there over the course of 4 or 5 years and actually building yourself as a top European name, because that's when you can start to attract the elite level type players, when they know if they come to Aston Villa, they're going to be playing for a top European side, not guessing at whether they're going to be playing European football or not. And going back to West Ham, that's probably what hampers them signing the top boys and probably getting the one slightly under. So obviously good signs for Villa, but the consistency is key now. So let's see how it progresses. But like I said, I fancy them to do well in the Champions League, and they're a tough team for anyone to beat in the Prem.
Tomo, in Morgan Rogers, a young lad who's obviously come in from the EFL and made the step up into the Premier League seamlessly, and he looks like he's destined to have a big career.
Yeah, he's definitely been one of the most impressive players of the Premier League so far this season. I think his performance against Arsenal was the standout from that. Even though Villa lost that game, he was unbelievable. And actually, so I think he came in January, did he, from Middlesbrough for $8 million? And I spoke to a couple of Middlesbrough fans who go every week, and they were sort of laissez-faire about him leaving for $8 million. And when you look at his form this season for Villa, and to be fair, before this weekend, I don't think it had translated into goals or assists, but he got the two assists this weekend. But his performances have been unbelievable. And maybe, I know he was deployed as a number nine at Middlesbrough, And he's obviously being deployed alongside Ollie Watkins here in that number 10 role and sort of almost given the free role, if you know what I mean. Maybe he's more suited to that, but he's definitely stepped up. And yeah, he just seems like almost when he's sort of on his marauding runs, it feels like he's playing like men against boys. He's so athletic. He's so powerful. And like I said, if he can turn those really impressive performances like on the eye into goals and assists, which he did this weekend, then yeah, he'll definitely be one to watch for like the next England squad as well.
Yeah, he must be something that someone who Lee Carsley's thinking about bringing up into the squad, especially with if Lee Carsley squads to continue how they have been and pulling people out of the kind of youth teams that have played from before in the under 21s. And I'm sure Morgan Rogers has been representing England across all age groups. I'm sure he'll be one of the future ones. I just want to call out John Duran as well, who bides his time on the bench for Aston Villa, has limited minutes, normally comes on alongside Ollie Watkins or in replacement for him, but just seems like an absolute bagsman. He obviously scored the winner against Everton. He had an absolutely unbelievable finish in the Champs League, which was rather cruelly ruled out. And he was off the bench to put it to bed at the weekend against Wolves as well. I know Chelsea were linked with him in the summer, and I think that got fairly close. But yeah, I think he could go on and play for a very big team and be starting and scoring goals for them because he's looked unbelievable. But it's probably frustrating for him that he runs into Ollie Watkins.
But that's a really good example of how strong Villa are now. And he was linked, wasn't he, with West Ham in the summer. And it feels like, well, why would you like drop down when you're playing Champions League football for Aston Villa? And yeah, he's definitely taking his chance. But it's just an example of where Villa are at. They're now a top four, top six Premier League club, and they've got the squad to rely on. But at this time last year, if you remember, Yuri Tielemans had just signed from Leicester and he'd come out and he was basically saying that unless I start playing games, I'm going to have to leave straight away. And now you look at him and he's playing in that central midfield and he's one of their best players. So they're just a really, really good squad, really good team under a really good manager. And yeah, it'd be no surprise if they finish in the Champions League again this season.
That strength in depth you just spoke about, I just looked at their players they brought on off the bench on Saturday. They brought Leon Bailey and Ian Mattson on at half-time. They brought Ross Barkley and Duran on for Ramsey and Onana. And then Emi Buendia came off the bench right late in the game for Ollie Watkins when it was done and dusted. I mean, what a great squad they've got. And obviously, they've got games to come. I think they've got Wickham midweek this week in the Carabao Cup, but then they've got Bayern Munich home the week after in the Champs League. So they're going to have lots of games, Villa, and they're going to rely on that squad, but they've got some serious strength and depth there. That all with Matty Cash, Boubacar Kamara and Tyrone Mings and Philogene all out injured, who will be looking to get into that squad. So mad what Emery's building there. So fair play to them. So this week sees the start of the Europa League, lads, and Tottenham and Man United enter the competition. Similar format to the Champions League with the group stage, big group stage happening, but no Champs League team are going to drop down into the Europa League this year like has happened previously where third place teams have gone into the Europa League. So probably a big opportunity for one of those sides to go on and win the competition. Laurie, do you think for Tottenham and United, it's actually a better opportunity with the Europa League set up like that than the Premier League with how competitive that is to get Champions League football?
Yeah, I think it's probably a better opportunity than the FA Cup or the Carabao Cup as well, because you're not going to face Man City, are you, or Arsenal or Liverpool. You're just going to face the Europa League teams. I must admit, I couldn't really give a toss about the competition. I think everything below Champions League is Mickey Mouse, really. So good luck to those vying for the kind of BTEC trophies. And I think, you know, particularly Tottenham will have a big eye on that. And it would be a good trophy for them to win. Man United have won it before. And, you know, I think really looking at getting back into the sort of echelons of Champions League discussions. But yeah, definitely a good opportunity and possibly the easiest route to silverware for some of those struggling clubs that think they're big but haven't done anything for a long time.
Well, I've just had a look at the 36 team league, like the league table, and it's the weakest Europa League I've ever seen. And it's obviously going to be the weakest because the Champions League has got bigger, so they've got more teams in that. But if you're Man United and you're Tottenham, you'd be disappointed if you didn't get to the final, genuinely. Like the level of opposition, in the Europa League seems to be, just getting even worse. So, yeah, if you're Ten Hag and Postecoglou, that's a massive competition. My point being is it's the Premier League is so difficult now and so strong. You've got 10 teams that are vying for 6 places, whereas the Europa League, if you win the Europa League, you get into the Champions League. And if you look at that league phase, okay, there are a couple of good teams in there, but Man United and Tottenham should be the strongest teams and they should be getting to the final. Absolutely.
I've just looked at the table for the Europa League and I'd probably go one step further. And I think the jobs of Ange Postecoglou and Erik ten Hag have to be questioned if they're not in the final. Because the excuse not to be winning the Premier League for the last 11 years in Man United's case or 110 years in Tottenham's case is that there's always a Man City or an Arsenal or Liverpool. I honestly can't see a team that if either of them come up against here, they shouldn't just be beaten and they won't be favourites again. So it's not just could they be looking at that to win the competition. They should be. Presumably they're the two favourites. So yes, absolutely one of them must win it.
Yeah, I think the only team I'd picked out who I know United face in one of their 8 group games is Porto. I know that they obviously ran Arsenal pretty close in the Champions League last year, but you're right. There's nothing there that should be scaring either Tottenham or Man United. And if it's a Portuguese league team that's your main rivals in that other than each other, then it's something, as you say, that they really, really need to have one eye on going very deep in the competition. Boys, let's move on to the EFL then. And West Brom find themselves top of the table. They played Plymouth at the weekend and won 1-0. And Tomo, Josh Maja scored. A name that first came when the Sunderland Till I Die documentary was out, I think in 2017-18. He was linked with a move away. I know he's been active in France as well while he's been over the last few years. But just talk about his resurgence a little bit.
Well, he's had a bit of a stop-start career, isn't he? But he joined West Brom last summer for free and then basically got injured all year. So he's almost felt like a new signing this year. And Laura, you spoke about Brandon Thomas Asante leaving West Brom. So that obviously leaves that position up for grabs. And Josh Madger's, well, I guess he's taking it with both hands. He scored a hat-trick in the first game of the season. And if you watch the highlights of that game, it was all sort of 6-yard poachers finishes. And the goal on the weekend against Plymouth was that as well. Wayne Rooney, the Plymouth manager, come out and praised him after the game. And he basically singled him out by saying, look, he's a difficult man to... I'm paraphrasing here, but he's basically said he's a difficult man to mark because in play, he almost drops in as a false nine and like links up the play and does everything you want sort of from a number 10. But most of his goals this season have come from inside the 6-yard box. And he's almost like that number 9 poacher's goal, like poacher's finisher. So, yeah, it's nice to see him doing so well, to be honest, because his career's been ravaged by injuries. And obviously, if he can stay fit for the whole season, then West Brom have got one of the best bagsmen in the Championship.
And I'm surprised to see West Brom at the top of the table as well, because I just wasn't expecting them to have such a good start, to be honest. But they've beaten Plymouth, Portsmouth, Swansea, Stoke. They did draw with Leeds, beat QPR. So tougher tests to come for them. But they'll be dependent on him scoring some goals, I imagine, to keep that form up. Wider in the Championship, there were wins for Sunderland, Burnley, Leeds and Sheffield United. Important for Leeds to get back to winning ways. Sunderland won as well. Chris Rigg scored a goal. So he's 17 years old, catching the eye of Premier League teams, apparently. Linked with some big clubs as well. Man United linked with him. And I just want to touch on, we've just touched on there about Morgan Rodgers. We've spoken about Adam Wharton before. Laura, do you think Chris Rigg, like for him, he needs to continue getting some time at Sunderland or maybe target like a slightly smaller Premier League club to for his development rather than go straight to a massive club if the opportunity arises?
Yeah, I don't think Chris Riggs should be thinking about anything, really. He played 20 games last season and he's played, what, five this season. He's at a massive club in Sunderland who are looking to win the league or get promoted. The ideal scenario for him, in my opinion, would be get promoted with Sunderland, then have a year in the Premier League, probably in a bit of a dogfight and trying to come out the other side of that, and then assess your options afterwards. There's no rush. He's a young player. He's a good player. Someone that looks like he's going to be a good player at a big club. And the way that he took his goal at the weekend, I don't know if you saw it, it was kind of like a deft back heel on a loose ball on the touchline. So he's obviously got a bit of confidence and the presence of mind to do that in front of 30, 40,000 fans at Sunderland. So the signs are good, but I just don't think we need to be talking about him going to play in the youth team at Tottenham or Man United at the moment. Just let him have a good season at Sunderland and see if he can help actually achieve something before taking a big money move somewhere.
And in Sheffield United, they won 1-0 as well against Derby. And I don't know if people have seen the goal, but Gus Hamer scored again. Absolute cheat code in the Championship. Free kick, bent in, and great finish for him. But they're keeping the pace. And then Burnley, they won 2-1 with a Josh Brownhill. I think it was 94th minute winner against Portsmouth. Really weird goal. It seems to go in slow motion from range, but massive win for them as well. But yeah, some big clubs there. In Sunderland, Burnley, Leeds, Sheffield United joining West Brom in that sort of top part. I think Blackburn are the other team in there who drew with Preston, but shaping up quite nicely that top six in the Championship. So looking forward to the upcoming weeks in that league. In League One, just very quickly, Wrexham and Birmingham both won again. I think that's going to be a great battle this season. Wrexham obviously lost to Birmingham, but back to winning ways, and Birmingham won again. So really looking forward to watching those guys battle it out. And then in League Two, Gillingham won at Notts County. They keep winning. So Mark Bonner, who's moved to them, has had an unbelievable start. Massive win at Notts County. They're level on points with Barrow, who are absolutely flying as well. So yeah, Gillingham, keep it up. One thing I just wanted to touch on, Tomo, did you see Wimbledon's pitch flooded and collapsed with the recent rain? And they were meant to be taking on Newcastle in the Carabao Cup this week, but been moved to next week now.
Yeah, it looks like, I don't know if anyone's, I implore people to go and watch that or go and see the images, but it looks like half the pitch has basically got bunkers on it. Like, I'm not sure how flood damages work, but yeah, the pitch it seems like it's caved in on one corner and everything's sound. So yeah, the Newcastle players, go there. If you're going to go there, take your golf clubs.
It's been moved back up to Newcastle next week, I think, midweek. So like Wimbledon fans who've obviously got tickets to watch them against a massive team at home in a midweek game under the lights, the rain's come, their pitch is now fucked, for want of a better word. And now they've got a traipse up to Newcastle for a midweek Carabao Cup game. So be some serious dedication from Wimbledon fans to go up there. But yeah, disappointing for them as well. They've made a great start in the league. I think they were in the playoffs, I think, fifth, 13 points from six games. So they might now have some fixtures where they're going to have to ground share with someone else because their pitch looks like it's going to be unplayable for weeks and weeks. So be interesting to see if their form drops off at Wimbledon. So have to, one to keep an eye on. And then, Laurie, just want to finish up with a bit on Yeovil. So three games for Yeovil, last three games. No goals scored, a little bit of a sticky patch of form. And I think they go to Sutton tonight, don't they, where they'll probably be looking to pick something up and get back to some sort of form.
Yeah, I expect they'll be hoping not to lose tonight. I just think the last three games, we haven't scored a goal, a little bit of a lack of quality. A lot of the players that find themselves in non-league, it's not because they're not good footballers, but it's that consistency. One month you'll have three away games and score 10 goals. The next month you score none. You've got to do it all the time. You've got to be able to keep doing it in key moments. So, yeah, sticky run of form, but we're talking about three games. Before that, we won three out of four away fixtures and we'd have all been happy with that. We're 16th in the league at the moment. Before the season started, we were 16th favourites. Every fan seemed to think we'd finish about 16th. So it's fine. It's an okay start. And like I've said before, we're just sort of waiting to see which way the pendulum will swing, really, as to whether we're going to be a mid-table side as we look at the minute, or whether it's going to get worse or maybe a little bit better and we can push for the playoffs. But at the moment, it's just a lack of quality in the forward areas, because we've actually got a really good defensive line. The back four are fantastic. The goalkeeper's improving, and we just need to see some spark at the other end of the pitch to start bearing some fruit from our games. But tough game tonight. Steve Morrison, Sutton. I was thinking they had a 3G pitch, because they definitely used to, but I think they might have had to change that when they went up to League 2 for a couple of seasons. So a normal game, not too far away, and hopefully we can pick up all three tonight.
Yeah, I saw some highlights from a previous game on a 4G pitch, but they were saying that, I think, obviously where they went up, they had to change it. But both teams, I guess, have had a promotion and relegation in recent years, obviously going into different leagues. But yeah. Back meeting each other tonight. Just in National League, just to call out that there's joint leaders at the minute after 10 games, Barnet, Forest Green and York City all on 21 points. And then Eastleigh, Rochdale, Oldham and Gateshead make up the rest of the playoff places in that top seven. So Yeovil not a million miles off, though, you know, 3 points and they'd be back up into eighth place. So yeah, it'd be really good if they can pick something up tonight. Boys, that's all we got time for. Laura and I are off on holiday for a week, so we will be back next week, but it'll be towards the end of next week where we will pick up on all the upcoming action, including European fixtures, some League Cup games, and of course the Premier League and EFL. But cheers, boys. Pleasure as always.
Cheers, lads.